Greetings and salutations, everyone. I am AC2GS. My name is Roy, and I'm the control operator for this, the Limark Technical Net. It's been going on for more than 44 years. Every Sunday night at 8 p.m., we sit in front of our radios and chat with each other and entertain each other, inform each other, learn from each other, and I thank you all for joining me again this Sunday night at 8 p.m. when we try and do it all over again. I will drop and return with the usual links. If you want to reach me through email, that would be either for what we used to call mailbag questions. Those are questions normally asked on the technical net, but if you're not in radio distance, you can email them to me and we can discuss them over the air, and you can listen to either the live feed on the internet or the archive files that are available on the on a website. Or if you have a TechNet puzzle, we're always looking for TechNet puzzles. They're as rare as hen's teeth, and I find them very entertaining and an environment where we can discuss all kinds of interesting things. So if you have something like that, feel free to forward it to me, and if it's appropriate, I'll give it a try. Also, if you have an expertise in some technical field that's in the news and you'd like to share it with us, notify me and we'll give you some time for that. Or if you saw something about space and NASA and you wanted Paul's take on it, you could, of course, directly email him. His email address is spacenetreport@gmail.com. But you could email me and I'd forward it to him if you want me to. My email address is mailbag@ac2gs.com. I also collect a bunch of interesting YouTubes and articles over the previous week, and I put it in a page on the internet, a list of links. All you need to do to reach it is to type into your browser roy.ac2gs.com, and that'll give you the links. And they're available 24/7. We keep them up for years. There's a chat room available. Sometimes it's quiet, sometimes it's loud and noisy. If you want to reach it, you type into your browser chat.ac2gs.com. And as I mentioned earlier, we offer an internet audio stream of the technical net, and I leave it live the rest of the week. So you can listen into the Glen Oaks repeater, even if you don't have a radio. You get there by typing into your browser technet.ac2gs.com. And that'll bring you the audio stream. And as always, I like to remind people that Mike, KC2NJI, has a great archive site. It's called amateurradio.tv, and it has archives of the technical net that go as far back as September of 2006. So a lot of wisdom from hams that have left the area or unfortunately passed away and become silent keys. So, but their wisdom lives on the archived audio files. So take a look. There's a lot of material. Not all indexed, but there's still lots of material. Let me drop, and I'll tell you what I got planned. Okay. I have a couple of things to talk about at the top of the technical net tonight. So the next transmission will be me chatting about that, and you're, as always, free to remark, comment, agree, disagree, what have you. After we're done with the opening comments, we will open the net to the usual questions of a technical nature, preferably amateur radio related at the beginning, because this is an amateur radio net and an amateur radio repeater, but we are open to any and all discussions of technology and science, and I will try my best. So that should take us to approximately 10:15. Paul will join us, WS2N, with the SpaceNet report, which should take us approximately to 11 p.m., and I will return to tie a bow on everything and wish you well for the following week. That's the plan. If my Shaq's electronics continues to work, I don't fall out of All-Star or anything wacky happens here. And equally, if nothing wacky happens at the repeater site, it's been known to happen to both of us every so often. So hopefully we will have a pleasant, blessed, error-free, problem-free session tonight. So I will drop for a second and go into a couple of things I wanted to mention. AC2GS here. As is often the case, I always like to keep people up to date with the state of the art in artificial intelligence. And our buddies over at OpenAI have blessed us all with yet another MLM, large language module intelligence, artificial intelligence set called small case 01. I don't know how they think of these incredibly terrible marketing names, but this particular version is not GPT. It's not a GPT 4, 5, 6, or 7. It's a supposedly different model that's designated a lowercase O, 1. It comes in three flavors. At this time, if you are an OpenAI Plus member, you can use the O1 Mini model or the O1 Preview model. The final O1 in all its glory is not yet in release form for anyone but beta testers. The novelty of this particular engine is that it has some recursive functions where it feeds the information back into itself. I don't know if that helps or harms it. So they call it thinking, and you can actually look up the logs and see what it's thinking about. So I assume, hopefully, the next generation, or at least for the sake of the OpenAI guys, the next generation of generative artificial intelligence. And we'll see what they brought on us this time. So it's supposed to be a bit more sophisticated, supposed to be significantly better at writing programs. So if you own a company that hires program writers, you can fire them all and hire OpenAI. It's a brave new world, unfortunately. Anyway, anyone want to comment about the new OpenAI model, lowercase O1? Okay, I will take that as a definitive no thank you, or I'm finishing my drink or my sandwich here. My mouth is full. Maybe I'll talk about it later. So if you want to bring it up again later, that's fine. My other little point that I wanted to mention tonight is they just published something called the Ig Nobel Prizes, which is a takeoff on the Nobel Prizes. They're for people who've done proper scientific research into things that seem to be rather silly. Now, keep in mind that all these research projects that won the Ig Nobel Prize were proper research products, research projects, and were published in significant journals of science, which only goes to show you how insignificant journals are. Anyway, the Nobel Peace Prize was given to B.F. Skinner for experiments to see the feasibility of housing live pigeons inside missiles to guide the flight paths of the said missiles. So I'll let you contemplate that. The Botany Prize was won for finding evidence that some real plants imitate the shapes of neighboring artificial plastic plants. The Anatomy Prize was won for studying whether the hair on the heads of most people in the Northern Hemisphere swirls in the same direction, clockwise or counterclockwise, as hair on the heads of most people in the Southern Hemisphere. A little bit of a take on the Coriolis effect, I guess. The Medicine Prize was for demonstrating that fake medicine that causes painful side effects can be actually more effective than fake medicine that does not cause any painful side effects. The Physics Prize went for demonstrating and explaining the swimming abilities of a dead trout. And the Physiology Prize went for discovering that many mammals are capable of breathing through their anuses. And the Probability Prize was given for showing both in theory and by 350,757 experiments that you can flip a coin. When you flip a coin, it tends to land on the same side as it started. So much for probability. The chemistry prize went for using chromatography to separate drunk and sober worms. Let me drop a second so I don't time out. Okay, and the demography prize went for detective work to discover that many of the people famous for having the longest lives lived in places that had lousy birth and death record keeping. The biology prize, and this is the final one, was for exploding a paper bag next to a cat that's standing on the back of a cow to explore how and when the cows spew their milk. Go figure. Anyway, those were the Ig Nobel Prizes. They do them every year. Any comments? Okay, well, I just threw them out. I thought it would amuse someone, someplace, somewhere. Once again, I'm AC2GS. This is the Limark Technical Net, and we're open for business. If you have any questions, comments, topics for discussion, preferably amateur radio related, but we'll take them all. Just hit that push to talk. You'll be your first name and your call sign.
And to experience both radio related and ham radio not related. And go ahead.
Okay, Wes recognized, and so is John. John, I hope all is well. I held on to that interesting antenna for the last 3 weeks, thinking that maybe we could talk about it. So if you're game later tonight, we can talk about it.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Back in the States and back in the net, yep. And I got another question, somewhat, you know, related, antenna related, too.
Okay, very good. Once again, I continue to be AC2GS. Anyone else would like to put their name on the list for tonight, please hit that push to talk and give us your first name and your call sign. Okay, hopefully people will come up with questions or comments or what have you later on tonight. Wes, let me just make sure. This is non-amateur radio related or this is amateur related? Would you mind if I take you after John, who just has amateur rated radio questions for tonight?
Yeah, the first topic to discuss is ham radio related, but take him first and then I take me later, because I'm going to take more time.
Okay, very good, Wes. Thank you. So, John, you're up. Let's talk about your new antenna, and as time progresses, maybe we'll kind of jump back to your previous antenna for a little bit further discussion. But please, what's your question for tonight?
Yeah, okay. Thanks again, Roy, and good evening to the net. I've been flipping through several antenna books on my morning coffee, two different vehicles, depending upon which vehicle I'm in. And the ARRL antenna handbook says in there that the highest gain dipole is a full-length dipole. And I know when we're talking gain, we're just talking that, you know, the signal is compressed in a certain direction. So that in that direction, you'll get a higher gain. I guess somewhere in there, if I keep digging, I'll find the answer. But from my practical experience, we use the half-wave dipole, and we can get it to resonate very well on a third harmonic, which, you know, most of us do with a 40 and 15 meter band. So I'm a little stumped here. I have some assumptions, but I think if maybe you guys could save me some time and rather than me digging and digging and digging and hopefully finding it. I know, for instance, a half wave 20 is not going to, function good on 40. So what's going on here? I'm assuming that it's, if you could get it resonant, it's a better antenna, but it's not resonant on the sensor fed. What exactly is going on here?
Not quite sure what you're asking. You have to keep in mind that when they say that it's the third harmonic, it's the third harmonic up, not the third harmonic down. So, in other words, if you had, say, a 30-meter half-wave dipole, you could use it to work 10 meters because it's the third harmonic of 30 meters is 10 meters. So I think you're going in the wrong direction there.
Maybe I didn't articulate it right, but my thoughts, I'm sure, were correct. 40 meters at 7 megahertz, we also use for 15 meters, which is 21 megahertz, and it works very well. So do you agree with that?
Say again? John, could you say it again, please?
Yeah, surely. 40 meters, which is 7 megahertz. That dipole can also be used and will resonate very good on 15 meters, which is 21 megahertz. So, a triple.
I thought you were going, because you started to talk about 40 and then 80 meters. So I was a little confused what direction you were planning to go. But, yeah, as long as you go up, you can't go down, but you can go up.
Okay, so holding that thought, this is my question. According to the ARRL antenna handbook, that they are stating in there that the best gain from a dipole, which we know is directional gain, is with a full wavelength dipole. So a 40 meter, well let's, I'm just jumping now to 20 meters. So a 20 meter, let me back up. A 40 meter halfway dipole will work very good on 40. But I know from experience it won't resonate on 20. But according to ARRL handbook, it should. Now, I don't know if it's impedance mismatch then that comes into play, but, again, they're stating that a full-wave dipole gives you the best gain, directional gain.
Okay. I mean, I'm going to have to look that up because you don't really get much real gain out of a dipole. A center-fed half-wave dipole has a nominal gain in free space of about 2.15 decibels, which ain't much. So, and since no one uses their dipoles in free space, but relatively close to the ground, the amount of functional gain from a dipole is, there's a little gain, but not much. I don't recall ever seeing the fact that a half wave, I mean, there are some real esoteric designs like Zeppelins, which I wouldn't just describe simply as a full-wave dipole. Center-fed dipoles at half wavelengths will have a nominal impedance of about 50 ohms. As you make them longer and longer, the impedance goes higher and higher. So if you have a center-fed a dipole that's a half wavelength on either leg, their input impedance is going to be about 3,000 ohms. So unless you have a 49-to-1 or a 64-to-1 Balun or some kind of heavy-duty antenna tuner nearby the feed point, the impedance is going to be so severe that your SWR is going to reflect a significant portion of the amount of energy you try and radiate at those antennas. So you have to play some games to kind of tune the impedances away from those 3,000 ohms that it would normally be.
Yeah, I'm kind of suspecting that maybe what they're alluding to is that if you match it, you'll get more gain with that. I'm going to, unfortunately with this Echo Link, I can't be on one page and read it to you and, transmit. It seems to me with the Echo Link, it's got to be, have that page open. But let me look at this again and see if I could work something out where I could. It's just a very interesting discussion there. For me, this antenna theory, again, it's something that we still don't fully understand. We got parameters. We have an experience. We have some knowledge, but there's a lot unknown. And, there's statements in there. I think it is, the most reputable source. Again, what I suspect is it radiates the best if you match it. But I didn't see them say that. I wish they would have. My experience, I know everybody else, if you have a halfway 40, you can't get it resonant on 20. Anything's possible, but you have a heck of a time. So, let me get back and read that, and I'll let you carry on, or whenever you're ready, we'll carry on with the discussion on that other antenna.
DDH with a comment.
Yes, John.
Just wanted to mention that dipole gain, that 2.15 or 2.14 dB gain of a dipole, is the gain over isotropic, which is a mathematical model. I should probably know it's a mathematical model that radiates uniformly in all directions of the sphere. So when they speak of the gain of a dipole, 2.15 dB or whatever, that's the gain over that easy to calculate mathematical model of an isotropic antenna. Also, the half-wave dipole for 40 meters becomes 3/2 wavelengths on 15 meters, which, as you say, is the third harmonic. Every time you add to that, when you it would also work up at 5/2 wavelength if you went to the fifth harmonic, which we can't transmit on, but the antenna would work there also. But now if you try to take that 40 meter antenna and go to 20 meter antenna, it would look like an open circuit, so you wouldn't be able to get any power into it, and that's why you cannot use it on 20. Okay.
Thank you, John. That's one of those little theoretical things. Because theoretically, half-wave end-fed should have the same problem. It should have an impedance of infinity. But because we don't live in a theoretical world and things aren't perfect, we don't usually reach zero or infinities.
But remember, the half-wave dipole for 40 meters... remember, it's 2/4 wavelengths of line. You can duplicate that by taking a 1/4 wave line with a ground plane. So if you took a 1/4 wave of wire with a ground plane, that effectively gives you the mirror image, because the ground plane gives you the ground reflection, which makes it look like a half wave. So a 1/4 wave of theta open at the far end, which is high impedance. When you go a 1/4 wave from that, that gives you a lower impedance, which is how you get your match. So you can view it that way.
Okay, but what I'm saying is when we start to talk about antenna properties in free space, we're talking on a kind of optimistic theoretical construct. That when you place them close to Earth ground in the real world, things that are supposed to have zero impedance that don't have zero impedance, those that are supposed to have infinitely high impedance don't have infinitely high impedance. If you look up the electrodynamics of, say, an end-fed half wave, the impedance, the calculated impedance in free space, I would assume would be infinite, right?
I agree with you. It is of course a mathematical model. I mean, but it's a good starting point. But that's why you can't use a 40 meter antenna on 20 meters unless you have a very good matching system, because the impedance is going to be very high. It's going to be extremely high, so it would be very difficult to match into it.
And I agree with you, although there are guys who put up doublets with open wire transmission line and with antenna tuners that can tune doorknobs, and they, you know, you can transform impedances into anything you want to. It's not the best solution. It has a lot of problems that you have to then deal with, but you could tune a doorknob using some antenna tuners. I mean, the amount of efficiency is terrible, which goes into a different discussion entirely. You could have a perfectly tuned system using a dummy load, but the efficiency of radiation of a dummy load should be terrible. Some are more leaky than others. Also, I agree with you that it's based on the gain is relative to an isotropic field, which I like to kind of describe somewhat as the way that light shines from an incandescent light bulb. It should kind of diffusely, uniformly cover, you know, 360 degrees. But the only other standard for gain would be based on a dipole, and it wouldn't quite make a lot of sense to define your increased gain relative to a dipole for a dipole. So, you know, although, again, isotropic is, again, another theoretical construct, it's probably the best. When people say that a center-fed dipole has a gain of 2.15 dI, it's isotropic, because if you said what the gain was relative to itself, the gain would be 1.
One or zero dB, exactly. The nice thing about the isotropic model is that it's just power transmitted over 4πr², the surface area of a sphere, at some radial distance r. So very easy to calculate, but doesn't exist in nature. Hi. Anyway, okay, I'll let you get back to it.
Okay. I mean, unfortunately, a lot of times our conversations will slip in and out of theoretical constructs and in and out of the practical world. The theoretical constructs hopefully are more understandable, but the practical realities are just what happens when you put all these things together. Otherwise, everyone gets confused. So thank you, John, as always, for sharing your expertise. John N2ZC, we can kind of touch upon, I still have on my link page, anyone type into your browser, roy.ac2gs.com, and go beyond this week to last week's list of links. Is an illustration of an antenna that to me looks a lot like a G5RV with strange values for the lengths of wires. It looks like a center-fed dipole, except that each leg is a half wavelength long. Then there's a one-quarter wavelength open line, a transmission line that is shorted at the bottom and tapped somewhere above that by coax, and the transmission line is operating as its own impedance transforming device. So the idea is that it's correcting for the heinous impedance that would come out of that antenna. And to me, that looks like a very weird G5RV, but antenna books will call it a two-element collinear dipole. The idea, I guess, being that each leg is really an end-fed an NFED antenna, and they're hooked up to different sides of the transmission line, which I thought that collinears are kind of connected in the same way in a serial fashion. So if anyone has the opportunity to look up that antenna and make any comments, I'd love, John, if you could make a comment. Because, I don't know, it really kind of looks like they're really stretching the concept of what a collinear antenna might be.
So I'll have to check it out. I'll have to look into that to see what's going.
Okay. If anyone else out there has the opportunity to take a quick look at my link page, again, it's roy.ac2gs.com. And if they have any opinions one way or the other, feel free. Well, once again, I think we got silence. But anyway, perhaps we'll talk to John later today, or if he can't get to see the page, maybe we'll do this. We'll touch on this again next Sunday. Otherwise, I think I've said pretty much all that I was going to say. That it looks to me again like it's you know, if both of those NFEDs were connected to the same wire, I'd say, okay, it's collinear. But since one NFED is connected to the center wire and the other connected to the shield, I don't quite know how that makes it collinear. But, again, maybe I'm having a problem understanding something.
Yeah, you know, when I was reading about that, there seems to be those, you know, that shorted part is a matching device being used there. And I don't know, I just got a feeling that sort of alludes to what you were saying in a theoretical world and not be able to get these results in a real world, but it'd be very difficult. You know, again, with the ARRL book, which, you know, great book, but sometimes, again, they'll make these statements of, you know, the full-wave dipole having more gain. And I forgot the number, but it was like 4.7 dB, I think. But they don't then go on to say about the problems that you'll have impedance matching with that, you know, which I wish they would, but kind of leaves you in this quandary like you are right now and I am, where you're saying, well, you know, maybe I don't fully understand this. I think I do, but maybe not.
Okay. I guess we'll pick this up, hopefully, if you're available and John is available next Sunday, and beat it up a little bit, you know, kick a dead horse. Another thing, if and when you have nothing better to do, look up extended Zeppelin, which is, I think, what they're alluding to.
Extended Zeppelin? Is that what you said?
Zeppelin, like the floating, that you used to fill it up with hydrogen, watch it explode. Zeppelin.
Okay. Is that the antenna that I know the old AM radio stations used to use, you know, in the 1930s and 40s? I think it was called a Zeppelin or a Zeppelin. Is that the antenna that you're referring to?
It's a variation. It's called the extended Zeppelin. That's where I think you get two legs at a half a wavelength. But they do some wacky little things, like portions of it are cross-connected with coaxial transmission lines. So, there are tricks that they use to change the impedances of it.
Okay, yeah. And just, you know, getting back to what the other station there, I believe his name is John Orfo, said, which is interesting, and going back to the ARRL handbook, again, if I'm understanding this right, that the halfway 40, which acts as a three half waves on 15, you actually get better gain, which is, of course, directivity, out of it when it's operating on the 15-meter band, which I found interesting.
Okay, but the problem also is, as you go to the harmonics, they're not simple radiation patterns. They get increasingly complicated. They develop nodes as well as peaks. And so it's not something you can steer these dipoles. So sometimes it works in your favor and sometimes it doesn't.
Yeah, you know, I'm looking at it now in that ARRL book, and it does. It has about six lobes to it, but they also make the statement that it has a 4.7 dB gain. So, you know, above that 2.15, we're looking at a 4.17 gain, which, you know, just caught my interest there. But, yeah, no, I noticed that. These patterns are very, very different, many different lobes. And, you know, the gain may be very, very directed, which now you don't have an antenna that you can move around like a beam. So, you know, just asking questions, reading, trying to increase the understanding, and hope I'm not being too much of a pain in the neck, being too specific with these nuances.
Not at all, John. And as a matter of fact, we have yet another John in the chat room. He's not able, unfortunately, to transmit to the repeater, so he listens to what's being said and he types in his comments. And he recently typed in a full wave dipole properly matched at the feed point, which is an important point, would have about a 1.8 decibel gain over a half wave dipole. So again, the magic trick is to actually match the feed point, which is somewhat difficult, but not impossible. Also, he writes an extended ZEP would have each side about 5/8 of a wavelength long and would have close to a 3 decibel gain over dipoles. So again, we'll table this conversation for the time being and give John VHB an opportunity to take a look at the illustration, and hopefully next Sunday we'll have a little bit more to chat about.
Comment.
Sure.
Hey, it's K2GJE. Not impossible to properly feed a full wave. I've done it. Sheet. Feed it a quarter wave off one end. Not at the end, not at the center. Over.
Yeah, there's lots of cute little tricks that allow people to do that. It's not inherent in the design. You can't just go out and put up a full-wave dipole with nothing else going on and expect to get much out of it.
You're not going to match it at the end. You're not going to match it in the center. Feed it one quarter off. You'll have a beautiful match. I've done it. Over.
Okay. Thank you, Ed, for your input. Did you have an opportunity to see that two-element collinear dipole device?
I don't know too much about collinears. Years ago, they had something called a lazy H that I think they were two half waves fed. They were mounted in the field, I think a quarter wave apart from the earth, and then you crisscross the feed with the center of the coax going to one and the shield going to the other side of that one, and then reverse it on the other dipole over, and they call it a lazy H.
Okay, I mean, that makes more sense to me than this. This particular one, basically, think of a G5RV, except that the legs of the dipole are half a wavelength long. And They feed into an open line transmission line for a quarter of a wavelength, then short it at the end, and then tapped a little bit higher so that you'll get impedance transformation of approximately 50 ohms.
I haven't seen it, but it's not coax to make a transmission match, over.
Yes, exactly. But my little problem is not that I could see where they could fundamentally be able to adjust the impedance to 50 ohms, but why they would consider it a collinear device, because it looks like a dipole that you're simply matching the impedance using a strip of coax, a strip of open line transmission line. So, I mean, I would kind of call that a dipole. I don't know. I'm not quite sure exactly why the books call it a two-element collinear dipole as opposed to just a dipole.
Above my pay grade, we got to resurrect K2RIW over.
I certainly wish we could do that. If you have any book on how to get that accomplished, feel free to send it to me. John KD2BD also says, you could feed a full wave dipole or actually anything with open wire with a properly designed link coupled matching network in the shack and get reasonable performance. Yeah, I mean, again, you can tune a doorknob, and probably you'd get much more effective efficiency with any kind of a length of wire as opposed to a doorknob. So, yeah, I don't have a problem with these things being tunable. I have just a problem with, again, nomenclature, that I don't really see it as a collinear device. Again, it's not like anyone really explains it. They just, in the antenna books, they say this is a two-element collinear dipole. Have a nice life. So, you know, it's a shame. I wish I had someone who could kind of tell me why it's collinear. It doesn't look like it's collinear. It looks symmetrical because, again, it's not connected to the same inputs. It's connected to the opposing output of a transmission line. So, I don't know, maybe it's a philosophical question. I don't know. Hopefully, one of these days, I'll find some clever guy who tells me why it's collinear as opposed to not collinear.
November 2, Zulu Charlie?
Yes, John. Everyone's a John, except for Ed. Yes, John.
Yeah, for Ed. Ed, you know, you said that you did get it matched, full-wave dipole, and I'm not quite sure if you said that it was a nightmare or it was a perfect match, but I'd just like to hear what your experience was with that.
Sure, Ed, take it away.
Yes, I had two places to mount some wire when I was in Europe, and the distance between the two places was the length of two half waves on 20 meters, and I really wanted to be on 20 meters because I was DX. So when I fed those three half waves on 20 meters, I fed it from one end a quarter wave off with no antenna tuner right to the tie network of the transmitter. I had a perfect match. I guess I was lucky. I had a perfect match. I spoke to the Eastern Seaboard every night on a continual basis while I was stationed in Europe. Over.
Comment?
Yes, please, comment.
Yeah, you mentioned that you had a perfect match feeding right to the PI network of your transmitter. That's the thing. If that was a tube transmitter, which with a PI network, I'm assuming it was, the PI network output network is a matching network. For example, my Ameritron Linear here has a Pi network output, I can match with that up to about a 3.5 to 1, almost 4 to 1 SWR. So the Pi network itself has quite a matching capability. The problem is when you have these solid-state transmitters, which don't have much of a matching network in it unless you have to get a separate matching device for it. But the Pi network itself of a tube transmitter has the ability to do quite a bit of matching on its own. Go ahead.
Ah, thanks. Yeah, I was going to kind of say the same thing. The magic word is that Pi network. In the old days, transistor-based transmitters are capable of operating at somewhere around 50 ohms of impedance. They're not designed to be 50 ohm impedance, but they work well at 50 ohm impedance. Vacuum tubes are. Vacuum tubes are voltage-controlled, high-impedance devices. So all of them, by necessity, had to have their own antenna tuner built in. The Pi network often was the one of choice, but there are others. Where people were tuning up, you tune up your final, you tune up your linear, you had to tune all those damn things up. So, I mean, that's where, back then, the antenna tuner was hiding out. So if you didn't have the benefit of a decent impedance transforming device, most likely that quarter off offset half full wave dipole would probably not be very tunable.
Had a very short seed line, so maybe that helped also. I don't think it was more than about 20 feet from the transmitter to the antenna. I was very lucky. I had all borrowed equipment, and I wasn't able to borrow any antenna tuner. So all I had was a receiver and a transmitter. Over.
Okay, but at least back in those days, you had a transmitter that had a Pi network. There are some people, a lot of people have internal antenna tuners, you know, Japanese and such, that are kind of good for 3-to-1 mismatches, but there are guys out there with radios without any tuners. They have to supply their own. So, hey, it worked out good for you. That's what really counts, and I appreciate you adding to the mix here. Say again, Ed, you got snipped off at the beginning.
I have a small question. The linears that they sell, most of them you don't have to tune. I guess they're just broadband. My curiosity is how that's accomplished. It's been a couple of years since I've been away from school. Over.
No, if you have a mismatch, you have to tune it. I have a Expert Systems 1.3 kilowatt, and it squeals like a pig if I show it anything more than a 1.5 or 1.6 to 1 mismatch. So some of them have built-in antenna tuners that handle it, but otherwise, if you don't have something like that, you have to supply your own. But no, they require impedance adjusting for beyond a certain point.
Okay, so you have to follow it evidently with an antenna tuner. Then there are no controls on the linear. I take it over.
It depends on the linear. Expert Systems does make internal antenna tuners. So you just kind of have it do its thing, and it adjusts internally the impedance matching. But if you don't want to pay the extra, I think it was $2,000+, you go naked and you run it through a separate antenna, impedance adjusting tuner.
Okay, I don't mind. Thank you.
You're welcome. Okay. Any other comments?
Yeah. One comment or question. Is it possible, I believe I heard it mentioned, that I didn't follow up, with the MFJ-259 or similar device to find an impedance location on a dipole? Is there, you know, is there a testing mechanism where you can use that MFJ-259 or another antenna analyzer and find out exactly where on a dipole you'll get a 50-ohm, 75-ohm input, et cetera?
Okay. I'm not quite sure exactly what the MFJ-259 is. Antenna analyzers come in different shapes and sizes. My experience has been with vector network analyzers, which are used as antenna analyzers as well. They will give you impedance measurements. I don't know of any setting where it will tell you where to put the center feed. The center feed of a dipole is usually lowest at the feed point, the lowest impedance feed point of a dipole is at the center. And as you slide it off center, the impedance at resonance gets higher and higher and higher. Other than physically shifting the feed point along the antenna and recording the impedance, that's the only thing I can think of. There's no kind of setting for a VNA, and you know, if Ed or John knows otherwise, that'll tell you, you know, how to move it off center and calculate the exact impedance. Feel free, but I you know, usually what happens is you either kind of fix it at some place. You take a measurement, you figure out what the impedance is, and then you figure some way to adjust the impedance as close to the feed point as possible so that you don't get too much reflective loss on your transmission line. But if any of our guys out there know better, please tell me.
I guess not, and that's what I thought, and that's what I feared. A lot of work involved. Okay, just another theoretical question. Thank you, Roy.
Yeah, I mean, theoretically, you can use antenna simulators, and if you're very clever with designing it right on the software, because you can make an infinite number of errors, it will simulate the antenna and give you the feed point impedance. Again, that's a theoretical calculation, not a physical one.
Oh, comment?
Sure.
And the only thing I just wanted to mention is just a reminder that speaking of impedance as high or low is one thing, but remember, impedance has a resistive component as well as a reactive component. For example, if you have an impedance of 50 ohms resistive along with 150 ohms reactive, either inductive or capacitive, that will be a severe mismatch, even though the resistive part may be 50 ohms. You have to tune out one way or another that reactive component if you want to have a low SWR.
Yeah, but I mean, in total, I think the percentage of reflection is based on the total impedance, which is a complex number based both on resistance and reactance.
Yeah, it would be, for example, if I had a 50 plus J150, which is 50 ohms resistive and 150 ohms inductive reactive, the magnitude of that would be the square root of 50 squared plus 150 squared, and there would be some angle, arctan of 150 over 50, something like that. So it is that magnitude which is going to really determine your SWR. But as far as tuning, you want to get rid of the, if you have a real part of 50 ohms resistive, you want to get rid of that reactive part, and then you can achieve a match.
Yeah, I agree with you entirely. I try to kind of explain it as best I can, more in terms of the Pythagorean theorem. Because pretty much everyone in junior high school did the Pythagorean theorem. A lot of people never quite got to trigonometry.
You know, Roy, I find a lot of the questions that come up about antennas and matching and stuff, it goes really back to AC theory. It's like we a lot of the material covered in AC theory really forms the basis of what we need for going into antenna analysis and impedance matching and stuff like that there.
Yeah, I would agree with you, but the problem is most of us didn't take courses in that.
Yeah, that's true. But I know what you mean. I know what you mean, Roy.
Yeah, I mean, it goes back to Mel. May he rest in peace. Before I was listening to the technical net, Mel was Dick's other half. And he did a great thing that I listened to on an archive. He pulled it out of a book that I was so impressed. It's long since out of print. It's Electrical Mathematics, where he was discussing how you can calculate the complex impedance given the value of the resistance and the reactance by just doing it being two legs of a right triangle. When you calculate the hypotenuse. The hypotenuse is the scalar aspect of the impedance, the number value. The phase angle has to do with the angle of the opposing the right angle in that triangle and such. So they also had a course for blind hams in Minnesota. I keep on blanking on the name of them, but I'll remember eventually. And they offered a lot of things. It included audio tapes with how to do complex impedance in your head, which was basically them saying the same thing. Just do it like a right triangle. The two adjacent legs are the reactance and the resistance, and the hypotenuse is the reactance and the resistance, and the hypotenuse is the impedance, the complex result in scalar. Again, impedance is not a scalar value. Impedance is a vector, so it has a scalar aspect, and it also has an angle.
Yeah, and that's why some of these newer antenna analyzers look carefully at the specs, because they will give a readout in resistance and in reactance and tell you whether it is inductive or capacitor reactance. Some of them just give you the magnitude and don't even give you the angle. So those are ones you want to stay away from. But the ones that give you the resistive component and then also tell you what the reactive component is, inductive or capacitive, that gives you a lot of information to see what's really happening.
Yeah, I mean, that was the big problem with the old MFJ antenna analyzers. A lot of them would not give you an indication of whether your antenna is too short or too long. It would tell you that there's a mismatch, but they wouldn't tell you what direction to go. Present-day vector network analyzers have shrunken in price so much. I've mentioned repeatedly NanoVNA, which is a lovely little toy to have. You know, 80, 90, 100 bucks, depending upon how big a screen you want. And that'll give you all this information. Plus, it's a two-port VNA. It was very expensive buying two-port VNAs up until about 5-6 years ago. Most VNAs that you saw were one-port for amateur radio operators. So nowadays, you get a lot more information with the VNAs at much lower prices. So a positive aspect for inexpensive Chinese gadgetry.
Yeah, I got one of those. They are beautiful little devices, get a lot of information, and by their very definition, vector, there you have magnitude and angle of your impedance. Yeah, a wonderful little device, very nice.
Yes, indeed. I love them. I have three. I have a nano BNA. I have and two others from different manufacturers that do somewhat slightly different aspects. That's my only two-port DNA, because back when I bought my first two BNAs, two-port BNAs were just too expensive.